Welcome to Inside Ivy Hoops, podcast about Ancient Eight round ball. Mike Tony, editor of Ivy Hoops Online. Good to be with you for another season of Ivy Hoops. It's really crept up on us. Very grateful and happy to be joined by IHO writer extraordinaire Rob Brown. We're just talking about how the season is it's gaining on us, Rob. Thanks for joining us. How have you been?
I've been all right. Thanks so much, Mike. It's great to be back talking Ivy Hoops. In some ways, the season never ends, right? I mean, there's always news that happens in the off season, so it doesn't feel like that our last conversation was in April. So. Very excited to have Media Day in the books, and you know, we're 2 weeks out from the start of the season, so it's great to be back talking about the Ancient Eight.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about, so let's dive right in. Let's start with those Media Days that you covered for IHO, Rob. First of all, already a really in-depth Media Day recap and season preview on the women's side that is on the website that you wrote, and there'll be a one for the men's coming up here very shortly, soon after this interview publishes. What were your just general takeaways from? Let's start with the women's side. You know, we've got obviously Princeton. You know, they don't. They just kind of reload and keep going, as you kind of alluded to in your post. Just any general takeaways from the women's media day?
Yeah, and I think you see that. You know, Princeton, a little bit more separation. You know, although I do think that there is they've come closer to the pack in the last couple years, but you could see this year 16 unanimous votes for first place votes for Princeton. So I see that at least in the university media group that there's a lot of confidence that Princeton will take the title yet again. Not a surprise. I mean, this is a team that did lose two major pieces, Julia Cunningham, Grace Stone, but you still have the player of the year in Caitlin Chen. You've got the co-defensive player of the year, Ellie Mitchell, who's one of the nation's top rebounders, the rookie of the year, Madison St. Rose, and it's also a program that just has a system in place, especially defensively with Carla Berube. I mean, it is a team that's locked in. They know their roles. They know the strategy. I think what's interesting with this year's team is there could be a little bit more offense. That maybe the one thing that held them back last year was the over-reliance on Chen offensively. But I think Madison St. Rose will be, you know, is 1 year older, more experienced. They have a large group of talented first years coming in, and they seem to be pushing the pace. And that was something that Carla talked about at the media day, that, you know, this is a team that's really pushing the ball offensively, and it's a little bit strange for her to see that. So she's kind of trying to kind of pull them back a little bit. But I think, you know, they've got a very challenging non-conference schedule, and it will definitely get them prepared for the league in January. Interestingly, Columbia and Harvard separated by one vote in the preseason media poll, with Columbia number two, Harvard number three. I'm not sure. I mean, those two teams are going to be battling. That's for certain. They played four times last year, and they were all close. I guess the first one wasn't close, but the other three certainly were. Columbia, as I mentioned in the post, it's kind of a testament to the way that Megan Griffith has built that program. It's not a rebuild; it's a build. That they could lose, you know, four starters and still be the number two team in the league. They've got Abby Sue, who certainly is in the running for Player of the Year. She played for USA Basketball this past summer with Angel Reese and a lot of other big-name NCAA players, so she certainly gained a lot of experience. Kitty Henderson is back. I guess I should say three starters, not four, that are lot of people. It's been a very deep team over the years, and they're going to certainly rely on that depth this year. They've got a number of new players, eight newcomers with a transfer from Maryland, a transfer from Bucknell. So it may not be the same team as last year, but they are going to certainly be in the mix. Harvard, there's a lot of confidence. You know, I think when Carrie Moore was speaking last week, you could just feel the confidence from her and the players, and it's understandable. They defeated Columbia in a thrilling overtime game in the Ivy semifinal. They pushed Princeton to the limit in the final. They had beaten Princeton during the regular season. They lost Mackenzie Forbes and Maggie McCarthy, which are two big losses from a production and leadership standpoint, but they've got Harmony Turner, who was a first-team All-Leaguer, Lola Mullaney, second-team All-League, and Elena Rodriguez, who was really probably the most improved player in the league, or arguably the most improved player in the league last year, you know, down low. You know, when Kathy Delaney-Smith was there, it was the last few years especially tended to be like one forward and four guards, and sometimes it was just five guards. And now you see the more traditional, you know, at least one post player, if not two post players at all times. So Harvard is a much more balanced team than they used to be. And you know, they have Katie Krupa, you know, who's going to be in that mix in the front line, and she can also hit from the perimeter. Abigail Wright is a first-year forward who is the brother of Princeton's Ethan Wright and the daughter of Tigers all-time great Ellen DeVoe. So, you know, a coup for getting her away from Princeton, and I think she's going to, you know, really make some noise this year as well. So I think Harvard's a really good position. You're going to see Penn and Yale. They were separated by about 9 votes. They're very close to each other. Penn, as Mike McLaughlin said, this is a Jordan Obie's team. And in the past, it was more Caleb Padilla's team, and now it's Jordan Obie's, and she's going to be the focal point. They've got to replace a lot of points, a lot of production, a lot of leadership from Padilla's. I guess she's a grad transfer now at USC, along with Mackenzie Forbes and Columbia's Caitlin Davis. So Penn kind of has to, you know, figure out a little bit who they are offensively. Obie is going to get her double digits. That's understood. You know, Simone Sawyer had some moments last year. She's now a sophomore. They're going to rely on her to be a lot more consistent this year, and they're going to have to really get some newcomers some role players from last year. Offensively, there's going to have to be, you know, someone to help Jordan Obie out, and that'll be the big mystery. Yale is kind of in an interesting spot. They only bring in one new player. They didn't lose anybody. The biggest loss last year for Yale was the injury to Camilla Embo. So she was out for the entire year. So this team has a tremendous amount of experience from last year. They have Jenna Clark, who was second-team All-Ivy. She's a tremendous point guard, you know, one of the top assist makers in the league. Nyla McGill, who really came on last year, had a really great year. She was co-defensive player of the year. Kylie Capstraw, who was definitely in the mix for rookie of the year. So, you know, they have a nice balanced attack. I think the issue with them is more offense. You know, they have all the pieces in place. It's just that the accuracy wasn't there. So if they can improve the accuracy, then I think they're going to give Penn a run for their money for that fourth spot. And that seems to be where things are playing out, with the top three not locked in, but very confident of their spots for the Ivy tournament in Columbia next March. But I do think that fourth spot will come down to Yale and Penn. I was kind of surprised a little bit about the conversation with Coach LeBlanc at Brown. That's a team that made tremendous strides last year, which was really nice to see. They went from one victory in the league to 4 victories. I think a lot of us at last year's Ivy tournament talked about the idea that Brown could really be in that mix for the fourth spot, and I think it's still possible, but she really emphasized the need for the team to get much better on the defensive side. And when you start looking at the numbers, it didn't seem as drastic as she made it to be. She, you know, the team offensively and defensively went from the low to mid-300s 2 years ago. Offensively, they were at 272 last year, and defensively at 206. But I think it speaks to the strength of the league on the defensive side, that Coach LeBlanc knows that that her team has to really step it up defensively. And so that was the majority of her conversation, that they really, if they want to make some noise in the league, they have got to really tough it up on the defensive side, especially in rebounding, where they were, you know, they were definitely still in the 300s. So if they can find a way to get better there, then I think they have that chance to be a dark horse for that last spot. But that's a big jump, you know, from the offensive and defensive round rebounding standpoint. And then you come up to the bottom part of the league, Cornell, Dartmouth. You know, Cornell has a little bit more experience than they have in past years. They have Emily Pape, who was a tremendous find. She, again, was another one of those people in the mix for Rookie of the Year. She's a forward, sophomore forward. She's definitely going to be the focal point of the team. But I just don't know if there's enough offense. You know, defensively, that's always been a strong suit for Cornell. Last year kind of dropped a little bit, so I think they have to kind of get back in gear. But I just don't know if the offense is there for them to kind of rise into that upper division. In some ways, Cornell has been kind of treading water while Brown has leapfrogged over them. And now you get to see that Dartmouth has a new coach, Linda Simino, who has rebuilt programs at Caldwell, at Binghamton, at St. Francis in Brooklyn. So she's no stranger to the idea of taking a program that's on rough times and getting him back in shape. There really isn't a lot for Brown. I mean, for Dartmouth, she really is starting from not square one, but pretty close to that. They were 0-14, 2-26 last year. I think this year, you know, her goal is to just kind of create a culture, you know, optimistic, high energy, controlled, you know, disciplined team. And I think that's the biggest goal for Brown. So, you know, if they can, I think they're looking at it more like, hey, you know, the top of the league is a pretty big hill to climb right away. So I think a lot of their energies are going to be focused on looking at Brown, looking at Dartmouth, maybe Yale and Penn. You know, can they be more competitive with those teams? And then once they clear those hurdles, then they can move forward in years 2, 3, and 4. But for right now, it's just, you know, starting at the building blocks.
Yeah, I was to go back up to the near the top of the poll. I was interested to see where Columbia would fall, given that we're kind of at a turning point now to losing the players that went into the build that you mentioned, not the rebuild, but the build that kind of made the program what it has become at this juncture for Megan Griffith. You know, Caitlin Davis, Jada Patrick, you know, Hannah Pratt, looking at those departures, and you know, where would Columbia fall? And they're basically in a second tier with Harvard, as you said, just one vote separating them. So that's interesting. I don't, just curious to see how that, where Columbia was, you know, was going to be projected. And it does say a lot about what Megan Griffith has built there, that, you know, they lose so much extraordinary talent and they're still considered a top two contender.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and I think something that that came up in my mind a lot during media day, you know, there's now a new women's basketball tournament that the NCAA will be running, and so there are 156 spots available for the postseason. And when you think about the Ivy League, the women's division is one of the top 10 in the country. And I kind of thought that there are at least 5 teams in the conference, you know, that can arguably be in that discussion for the top 150-plus programs in the nation. And the Ivy tournament, as it's designed now, is the top 4 teams. And I think if you're taking taking that fifth team and you're preventing them from being in the mix for that you know, several-day event in March, you're kind of limiting a postseason opportunity. And I brought that up a number of times. Is there any way that the conference will reevaluate or look at changing the makeup of the tournament, you know, in the years to come? It's not going to happen this year, but for future years. And I think there are comments along the lines of, you know, we're always looking, you know, at the future and seeing what holds. But I do think that there is an argument to be made that this is a conference that deserves to be highlighted, especially on the women's side. You know, that they really have earned that right to have that extra, you know, team in there and compete for a postseason title, or at least a postseason spot. One thing I will mention I didn't note before with Columbia is Abby Sue is two 3-pointers away from the league record, which I believe is held by Katie Benzin, former Princeton, former Harvard and University of Maryland star. So it's just I would presume that's going to happen in the first game. You know, she'll break that record, but you know, we'll see. But yeah, that was my biggest thought with the women's top seed grouping, is that there really is going to have to be a moment of reckoning for how this tournament is designed. But I think from the coach's standpoint, a lot of I think it was Coach Moore, Coach Griffith, really emphasized the idea that the tournament is the postseason bids are really played out more during the season than in the postseason. So there is this constant idea of the league has to schedule harder in the non-conference, and you certainly see Princeton, Columbia, Harvard have moved in that direction. Penn, by nature of being in the Big Five or the City Six, however it's verbalized now, they're always, you know, a competitive non-conference. But I think top to bottom, 1 through 8, there has to be, you know, a lot more, you know, across the board strength of schedule in order to make sure that the Ivy is a multi-bid league in the NCAA every year.
Yeah, you got to do what you can to make the case, even if you really shouldn't have to. You know, you gotta do what you can to best position yourself, that's for sure. Well, let's switch over to the men's side. You know, it's interesting how it shook out. Yale on top in the preseason media poll, and Princeton, you know, a somewhat short distance behind them, kind of comprising what could be considered the top tier. And then there's Cornell and Brown, and then Penn, which would be kind of a switch from how past Ivy standings have shaken out, with Penn sneaking in as the 4 seed, never missing the an Ivy League tournament under Steve Donahue, always qualifying for them. Brown just the opposite. Under Mike Martin, despite some very solid rosters and strong moments here and there. What did you take away from the men's media day, Rob?
Well, I think it certainly has to start with Yale. This is a team that tied for first. I think 3 of the last 4 years they've either been the solo champ or co-champ. They're loaded. I mean, yes, they lost second team all Ivy EJ Jarvis, 11 points, 5.5 rebounds a game, but, you know, they bring back Matt Noling, first team all Ivy, 63% from the field, Bez Mbang, honorable mention all Ivy defensive player of the year, John Pulakaitis is still there, Mahoney is there. I mean, like, they've got so much experience coming back, and there's a lot of depth. I think when you talk about losing Jarvis in the front line, yeah, that's a big loss. But Danny Wolf, who's 7 feet tall, he took Team Israel to the finals of the FIBA Under 20 European Championship this summer. Nick Townsend, who's another forward, brother of Matt Townsend, who played for the 2015 team, he led the team in scoring when they did their trip to Greece recently. You know, Coach Jones just kept talking about the depth. Yusuf Basa'ama is healthy will be ready to go. There's a first-year Samson Aliten who's 6'10", who's probably going to be in the mix. I mean, this is it's just an embarrassment of riches, if you will. So it's a team that's got defense, it's got offense, it's got a standard. I mean, there's a culture, you know, good shot selection, defensive rebounding, next man up. You know, there's always somebody learning and waiting in the wings so that when someone graduates, they just, you know, swoop on in. So, you know, it's hard to see Yale. They earn that number one spot. And right now, if everyone stays healthy, it's hard not seeing them, you know, being the team to beat, you know, in the preseason, I mean, in the conference season and in an Ivy tournament situation. Princeton, obviously you lose Tosin Aloman, who's, I think, now with the G League for Detroit. Ryan Langbord's off to Northwestern. Keyshawn Kelman was really another steady presence in the front court. So it's not going to be the same Princeton team. It's going to be a smaller team. But, again, this is another team that has and I think that's something that culture, and that's something that Mitch Henderson brought up a lot during media day. I think, you know, when you think about like the idea we talked about the Columbia women losing, you know, majority of their starting lineup, and you know, when they don't miss a beat, they're the number two team. Princeton's like that as well on the men's side. I think the big difference is Princeton. This is the second year in a row that they're basically going to have to rebuild 3/5 of the starting lineup, and they're not really missing a beat. Zach Martini will move into the front court. I took away from Mitch's conversation that a lot, I mean, we know that Matalongo is the spark plug of that team, but I took away that a lot is expected of Caden Pierce, who was Rookie of the Year last year. He's a forward, but I think they're also expecting him to really contribute, really, you know, in the 4 and 5 position, but they're also expecting him to be one of the main ball handlers. I know Princeton favors a positionless kind of attack, but it felt a lot like Caden Pierce was going to be put in that Noah Kirkwood role from Harvard a few years ago, where he's going to be expected to play 4 or 5 positions every night, and I think it'll be interesting to see how that goes throughout the course of the year. In terms of the backcourt, you've got there was a lot of Xavien Lee who showed some real promise last year. Jack Scott, whose father was a former Princeton player and coach, is in the mix. And there's also a heralded first year, Dalen Davis, who had some high major offers. So I think it's not going to be the exact same Princeton team, and the chances of them hitting the same kind of Sweet 16 heights as last year are certainly low, but I do think this is a team that is going to be in the mix, certainly for the Ivy tournament, certainly for Ivy titles. It's just going to be a little bit of a different team this year. Cornell, you know, they are the outlier in the Ivy world, right? They are a team that focuses much more on offense than defense. When you talk to the coaches over and over, the word defense, the first comes across almost every time. Not so much with Cornell. They know that their bread and butter is their offense. They've got 10 guys who are going to be playing major minutes. They're going to look to score 100 points a night, and really defensively, they're just looking to tweak a little bit. If they, you know, as Nazir Williams said during the conversation, if they can get a couple more stops towards the end of the game, so it's not really a wholesale change of the defense. It's really just, you know, some small moments late in the contest that they're looking to change. You know, they do lose offensively Greg Dolan, who was second team All Ivy, but I do think when you have this kind of style where you know 10 guys are going to play major minutes, and that those numbers will be found. I think Brian Earl is a tremendous coach. He always finds an unsung player to kind of get into the All Ivy conversations by the end of the year. You never know who it's going to be at the beginning of the year, but by the end of the year, you see that there's at least one or two guys who are in that mix. Dolan certainly fit that category. Nazir Williams, who was honorable mention last year. When you think about the idea that every year Cornell is in the lower half, and then all of a sudden they tend to exceed expectations. Now that they are number 3, it would not shock me if they I don't know if they have enough to battle Yale at number one, but it would not shock me if they move up to number two and flip roles with Princeton as the year goes on. I just think they are confident, they know who they are, and they have the talent to kind of outscore people. Brown at number four. I think we all are surprised, like as you mentioned, that Mike Martin's teams have never made the Ivy tournament when you think about the roster of talent they've had there. This year, I think it's the highest ranking they've ever had in Martin's years. There have been a number of fifth place selections, but I don't think they've ever been as high as number four. Keno Lilly Jr. is going to be the lead engine on the team. He was first team All-Ivy, one of the league and nation's top scorers last year. They have a great, talented duo down low, Nana Owusu-Anane and Kalu Anya, two 6'8 forwards who can protect the rim, they can defend out on the perimeter, and they can get the fast break going. They do have more depth on the front court than the back court. Front court, Malachi Endur and Landon Lewis are two players who the coach thinks will be in the mix for the front court rotation. The back court's the bigger issue. You know what you get with Lilly, but they lost Paxson Wojcik, who was second in scoring, first in three-pointers, first in free throws, second in rebounding. I believe he was the top assist maker as well. So he takes his production and his leadership skills, and he goes down to University of North Carolina. That's a big role to replace, and I think they are just looking at it from replacement by committee right now. Aaron Cooley is at the wing. He played 21 games. He started 21 games, averaged a little over 5 points. That's not going to make up for Wojcik's numbers, so they're going to have to find, some production from Kimo Ferrari, Felix Kloman, Sam Cloris, Lyndon Erold. So they're going to have to find somebody in that group, and that could be defensively, Mike's teams are always strong. It's really finding those offensive numbers this year, which could be the challenge. One thing I kind of pointed out to the coach, but he wasn't even thinking that far into the future, it's a team that's lost three of its last four games the last 2 years in a row. And then they were in the mix for an Ivy title and Ivy tournament bid and dropped off both years. This year, the Ivy schedule is a little bit different. The first seven games are held over 6 weeks. So there's a bit of a lull in the middle of the, the middle of the season, beginning of the conference slate. And I'm wondering if that will allow Brown to kind of regroup and get healthier so that they're ready for that push in the last 4 weeks when they're playing the last seven games, if that will be something really helpful to take them into the tournament for the first time. Coach Martin said he wasn't even looking that far into the future and wasn't even aware of the schedule change like that, but he said to check in with him in January and February and see, and so we will touch base and see if that's going to make a difference. So Brown is, they're in the four spot, but I think it's not a solid four necessarily. I think it's impossible to talk about Penn without discussing the offseason. Jordan Dingle, who was the player of the year, who was expected to come back for his senior year, was he put his name in for the NBA draft, got some feedback, and ultimately decided to transfer, where he'll be playing with Rick Pitino at St. John's. There are rumors of the world of the NIL being heavily involved in that decision, as well as playing for a Hall of Fame coach in the top media market. Trying to improve his chances for an NBA spot. So that was a big change for Penn. And then a couple of months later, we heard that Max Martz, who was an honorable mention All-Ivy, was medically retired. So now Penn, which was just expected to lose Lucas Monroe, their top defensive player and rebounder last year, are now out three-fifths of the lineup, including two of their three leading scorers, and one of those scorers was the nation's top scorer. So Penn went from a team that was expected to compete with Yale for the top to now being the number five. So this is going to be a completely different Penn team. It's no longer going to be focused on Dingle. It's going to be a lot, the wealth is going to be spread around. An interesting thing that Coach Donahue mentioned felt optimistic that he can kind of stick to lineups and not have to do that chess match that he had to do the last few years. The team is going to be led by Clark Slacker, senior guard, averaged almost 14 points a game. Nick Spinoso, junior forward, is going to be a key contributor as well. And these were two people in the starting lineup, but they're going to have to get more from Andrew Laskowski, George Smith, Ed Holland as well. So they're going to have to really get more production to make up for the loss of Martz and Dingle. We'll see. You know, I think the fan base is very passionate at Penn, and I know there's a lot of disappointment with the recent news over the last few months, and we'll see, you know, how tolerant people will be as the team kind of figures out who they are in the non-conference schedule and gets ready. I think if you're looking on the positive side, Steve Donohue always pulls a rabbit out of his hat when it comes time for conference play. You know, there have been times where they've lost six games in a row, and he finds his way into the Ivy tournament. There's always at least one, if not more, guys who don't even make noise during the non-conference schedule who find a way to be stars in one, two, or three games during the league play. So, you know, would it shock me if Penn found its way into that four spot? Definitely not. But they do have a lot to overcome. Harvard, just 7 points, I think. They were... Actually, they're just a couple points away from Penn, just 2 points away from Penn. It's an interesting thing with Harvard. They lost Chris Ledlam to graduation, first-team All-Ivy, who will actually be joining Dingle at St. John's. I believe he started off heading to Tennessee, but then when Tennessee got some additional transfers, he reopened his recruitment, and he'll be at St. John's. They lost Eden Tritow, you know, another starter, Sam Silverstein, who was a junior, played a really important role in the starting lineup. He's not playing this year. So it's going to be a little bit different team. I think they're going to take a step back offensively and defensively. Coach Amaker always has, you know, buzzwords for the new year. This year, it's opportunity, possibility, and I think the third word that was really prevalent in the conversation was balance. This is a team that's got a lot of openings and a lot of places for players to make their mark, to seize the opportunities, and I think they are looking for a lot more balance. This was a team that, the seventh in the league offensively, 254 in adjusted offensive efficiency last year. Not sure. You know, losing Ledman, those numbers may actually go down a little bit. I think a big key will be improving their three-point shooting, which was a real problem last year. Louis LeMond, who is a junior now, came in 2 years ago as a presumptive Rookie of the Year candidate, but he has had injuries, and it's not been the career that most have expected. So he's healthy this year, so hopefully that will change the fortunes for the Crimson. They've got a lot of good front court players, Chisholm Okpara, Justice Ogbor, you know, certainly Chandler Pige. So they do have players in the front court. I think the back court in the production is a little bit of more of a mystery. So I do think it's going to be a challenge for Harvard to make it into the Ivy tournament, which is, they have missed the last two, and that was with Noah Kirkwood and Chris Ledlam. Without those stars, this is the first year I can really imagine in many years where Harvard hasn't had that, you know, go-to, you know, star first team all Ivy. So, you know, the odds are really tough for them to make it, and I think it would be kind of shocking if we go back in time and say to someone, oh, well, you know, there's a possibility that Harvard won't make the tournament 3 years in a row. So that's kind of a big, amazing thing. So it's a little bit of a rebuilding job at Harvard this year, in my eyes. Dartmouth and Columbia were much lower. I think from Dartmouth's standpoint, I was a little bit surprised. They do lose Damon Delican, which is a major loss. He's going to be at Loyola Chicago along with Greg Dolan from Cornell. But they do have a lot of players with experience, 9 upperclassmen, 7 had meaningful minutes. It's not going to be the same offense. They ran it through Adelica in the last 2 years. It's going to be a more wide-open, balanced attack. focusing on athleticism, length, and speed. Ryan Cornish is going to be one of the main focal points of the offense. He's a double-digit scorer, kind of a really clutch shooter. Maybe the offense is where we've got to really look at for this team. Who's going to get those points outside of Cornish? There's Jackson Monroe, Jaden Williams have impressed in the offseason, in the preseason so far, but we're going to see it with Dartmouth. I the thing I find about Dartmouth is they're always a mystery. They're always a mystery in the preseason. They tend to be a mystery in the non-conference also. But somehow, when league play shows up, they are always a spoiler, and they always exceed, just like Cornell, they tend to exceed expectations. I don't know if this is going to be the year, especially losing someone like Adelican. If they can get somebody that really star alongside Cornish, maybe they make that run. But I do think it never would surprise me if Dartmouth exceeds the number 7 spot. Columbia at number 8, it's another step along the journey of rebuilding. I think 6 of the top 7 scorers are returning. I can't figure out who that missing person is. Columbia won't confirm it because all 7 are on the roster, but Lance Meadow, who did an amazing job in both media days, emphasized that it was 6 of 7 who will be returning. It's a team that defensively and offensively were in the 300s last year. Geronimo Rubio De La Rosa is definitely an all. Wasn't named to the All Ivy team, but he certainly is All Ivy caliber. Avery Brown is a really solid point guard and had a great first year. Zine Adine Bedri did a very nice job, at the forward position in his first year. They're going to have to get a lot more growth. This is a team that I think during the conversation more time was spent talking about their trip to Italy and the food they ate than what's going on with the actual program. So I'm no farther along in my awareness of Columbia than I was a week ago, but I do feel that there's a lot of experience, a lot of guys who've played before, and I think as Coach Engel said, there are a lot of guys who could kind of they figure things out. They know what the league schedule is like. They know how to balance academics and athletics. So I think there's certainly it's not going to be as new as it was for most of the players last year, but there's still a long way to go for that team. So that's kind of my take on the top on the 8 teams.
Yeah, it'll be interesting with Penn to see, because they're right in that right in the middle as they've often been. How whether they sneak in or not, the institution of the Ivy League tournament coming when it did, right at toward the beginning of Steve Donahue's tenure, really kind of changes the complexion of his tenure. If there was no tournament and finishing fourth didn't really mean anything like it did prior to 2016 when the tournament was instituted. I think it'd be easy to think about his tenure differently if there weren't any Ivy League tournament appearances to sort of notch under the belt, as it were. We'll see how it shakes out. They do tend to overachieve based on how rough sometimes they've looked, in the non-conference. And if they can get some of these two-way talents cohere as a unit, get some continuity, we'll see if they can make yet another Ivy tournament run, and if not, how unsettled does the fan base become as a result. But I think they've had a pretty solid showing under Donahue, all things considered, given what he inherited and what some of the off the court negatives that preceded him. But yeah, we'll We'll see how that plays out. What I wanted to ask, what's one big thing that you're looking forward to, one intriguing storyline on either the men's or the women's side coming into the season?
Yeah, well, I guess I mentioned a couple of them earlier. Like, one is the idea of the tournament going forward. Will they adjust it, right? We talked about the issue on the women's side to get more teams in the postseason, and I remember Coach Earl mentioning it last year during the intro press conference at Ivy Madness about the idea of, well, you know, we're tied with Brown, why us and not them? And you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there is a tweaking to this over time, you know, adding another team, finding a way to do that. And I guess another part of the tournament is, where will it be held going forward? You know, we know that it will be Columbia this year, which leapfrogged over, I think Brown was supposed to host it, but now you've got Brown, Cornell, Dartmouth, and the remainder of the Ivy schedule. Where will that be held? So that's something I'm just kind of keeping my eyes and ears open. The other part is, you know, one of these things about the world that we are in college basketball with the NIL, was Jordan Dingle's transfer. You know, he didn't graduate. You know, everyone else is a grad transfer in the Ivy League, and that's certainly another conversation to have. But Jordan Dingle has left Penn before he got his diploma. Now, I still can't get an answer to the question from Penn or St. John's about where will he inevitably get his diploma. So will he eventually go back to Penn in some capacity and get his diploma there? Or, you know, is it worthwhile for him to take that shot at the NBA, get NIL money, and make that leap to a high major? Is that more valuable than a degree? Because a lot of times when these coaches talk about recruiting, it's the 40 years more than the 4 years. You know, graduating from one of the more prestigious schools in the country, the networks that are made through those experiences. You know, is this a one-off with Dingle, or is this going to be the future? You know, would a Mieone a few years ago, if NILs were in the mix, would he have left Yale his senior year? And I don't know the answer to that, and that's going to be something interesting to see. But I think on the court, it's really going to be looking at Yale men and Princeton women. Are they as good as we think they are? And are they going to run away with the leagues, the two divisions? And then where are those battles for 2, 3, and 4? And I right now I see both as 5 teams for 4 spots. I think it's a little different than maybe on the men's side, the way the voting came out, but I see, you know, 5 teams for 4 spots, and we'll see, you know, but I do, you know, I'm very excited to see how each team kind of manages the preseason, you know, how they shake out the question marks up, who becomes more of a breakout player, how do they solidify the starting lineups for, and who are those key role players? I just think there's a lot of excitement heading into this year, and I think, you know, especially on the men's side, I think when we look at the tournament, it's highly likely that this is going to be a location with no home court advantage, right? Some people argued that Princeton, the number 2 seed, had home court advantage last year, certainly on the women's side as well. Well, this year, you know, from the men's side, it's arguably going to be, you know, wide open, so no advantage there. And the women's side, you know, Columbia had to go into Princeton last year. The year before, Princeton had to go to Harvard and almost lost. So, you know, now it's Columbia's turn. So it'll be exciting to kind of see how that all plays itself out. And so, yeah, a bunch of great stories. And I guess one that I haven't even talked about is Dartmouth, you know, trying to unionize the Dartmouth men, and they're dealing with court cases and the NLRB. And we're going to see how that kind of plays out. And also, 2 Brown players, one former, one current, have challenged the Ivy League to get merit scholarships, including athletic scholarships. So that's going to work its way through the court system. So there's a lot of on-court and off-court stuff to keep your eye on this year in the H&E.
Yeah, the off-court stuff is really the most intriguing stuff. The certainly, if you look at, you know, the NL or Barbie case with Dartmouth men's program, and Yeah, the NIL, what happens there? Those are two very existential issues that the league has to face, and that fans have to ponder too. If you step outside the Ivy League and you take a look at the college landscape, where you've got teams from the West Coast joining the Big Ten, and all kinds of topsy-turvy conference dashes going on. You can kind of maybe fall into a false sense of security, or perhaps stagnancy, with the Ivy League being the Ivy League and being the Ancient Eight in more ways than one. But the fact is, there is, change is coming, and in some ways it's already here in terms of how, what is an Ivy League, who is an Ivy League student athlete, specifically in the Ivy Hoops, quote, student athlete, end quote, and what does that mean, how we should think about that. So interesting stuff to ponder. And then on a lighter note, I'm interested to see how our Ivy Hoops audience takes to our new grid game, patterned after an immaculate grid by Ivy Hoops expert Kevin Whitaker for the site. I encourage anybody who's missed it so far to check it out. Ancient Nine, Ivy Hoops grid game devised by Kevin Whitaker.
Yeah, Kevin's had a lot of, literally, I don't know how long this is for Ivy Hoops, but he's a long time, Princeton writer. So it's a lot of great content, especially between George and Steve and Kevin. Certainly have them, a lot of knowledge on the Tigers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, they're a good program to know a lot about. But yeah, no, we've got a lot of great writers that cover the league, not just Princeton, and certainly you're grateful for all your expert insight, Rob. Rob Brown, thank you so much for coming on. Hard to believe we're just 2 weeks away, but it's great to be with you, Rob. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm hoping it's a
Yep, that's the bottom line. Good place to leave it. Thank you so much for jumping inside Ivy Hoops with us, and we'll be talking to you again soon.